think the most important thing to take away from this decision is the one thing it didn't address, the one thing they were most terrified of, going anywhere near the factual findings in the district court in Denver that Donald Trump was, in fact, an insurrectionist. And as far as I'm concerned, Donald Trump, just as he's an adjudicated rapist, remains an adjudicated insurrectionist, even if the Supreme Court has wrongly held that the states do not have the power to enforce Section 3 of the 14th Amendment as against potential candidates for federal office.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to George Conway Explains It All to Sarah Longwell. I am Sarah Longwell, publisher of The Bulwark, and I am here with George Conway for an emergency episode, because today we got a decision from the U.S. Supreme Court in Trump versus Anderson overturning the Colorado Supreme Court opinion that had disqualified Trump from the ballot for insurrection under Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. But before we get to the substance, I need to ask, what is a per curiam opinion, which is what this is? What does that mean?
Well, per curiam is Latin for by the court. And what this is just it appellate courts occasionally write per curiam opinions where no individual judge or justice signs the opinion. And that's all it means, is that it's an opinion that's not signed by any individual of the court, but it is the opinion of the court.
And meaning all of them?
No, all of those who join the opinion. But it is an opinion of the court, and it was joined in its entirety by, well, not quite in its entirety, but joined in its entirety by five justices, and joined in substantial part by Justice Barrett, and then joined only as to the result or the judgment, but the bottom line, by Justices Kagan, Sotomayor, and Jackson.
Oh, that's pretty interesting. So everybody came to the same conclusion, but they have different reasons. And so they're
right.
All endorsing the opinion, but not necessarily
right.
The
correct.
How they
it
got
is
there.
It is a, you know, and that's actually the last paragraph of the per curiam opinion and Justice Barrett's opinion chose to emphasize, is that this is a unanimous holding of the court reversing the Supreme Court of Colorado.
Okay, that is interesting. So today the court decided, and I'm reading directly from the opinion here, that because the Constitution makes Congress, rather than the states, responsible for enforcing Section 3 against federal office holders and candidates, we reverse. So can you walk us through this, man?
Look, I mean, this opinion is garbage. And it's not surprising garbage, because I don't think anybody after that argument thought that the Supreme Court was going to affirm in any way. And frankly, having talked to advocates of the 14th Amendment position, including some very, very serious ones, including people who were involved in the litigation, no one from the very beginning believed that it was more likely than not that plaintiffs would prevail. That being said, I always, you know, when I first started focusing on this, which was when the Colorado Supreme Court decision came down, I thought they'd come up with something better. I mean, I thought the plaintiffs would end up losing one way or the other. But I was surprised at the weakness of the arguments in favor of Trump. And I thought they're going to have to come up with something better. Well, it turns out the court never did. Nobody ever did. I mean, the best argument they ever came up with, the one that was said to be such a bulletproof argument, you don't see a trace of it in this opinion, which is the argument that somehow the president is not an officer of the United States. I mean, that was the number one argument pushed by the Trump lawyers, and you don't see that anywhere here. I mean, basically what the court did was it just decided it didn't want to play. It didn't want to address the language of the 14th Amendment, and it decided to basically, out of a fear of, I guess, opprobrium, but also a fear of conflict among the states, they made up a rule. And the rule that they made up here was that only Congress can provide by statute for the disqualification of a candidate for federal office. And again, there's no textual basis for that anywhere in the Constitution. And there's really no historical basis for that anywhere in the proceedings that the congressional and other proceedings that accompanied the enactment of the 14th Amendment. It was basically a decision that they made that they didn't want to have anything to do with this case. And the rationale that somehow this provision has to be enforced through a statute of Congress is inconsistent with the way that the court has interpreted the 14th Amendment generally and consistently over time. And it's inconsistent with the notion that somehow Section 3 can be enforced by the states only as to some candidates, namely candidates for state office, as opposed to candidates for federal office. There is simply no coherent rationale to this opinion. And that's just not surprising. I think the bottom line, I think the most important thing to take away from this decision is the one thing it didn't touch, the one thing it didn't address, the one thing they were most terrified of, which is going anywhere near the factual findings, which were made on a very extensive record in the district court in Denver, that Donald Trump was, in fact, an insurrectionist. And that is the most important takeaway, I think, of the day, is that they were absolutely not going to touch that one way or the other. And as far as I'm concerned, Donald Trump, just as he's an adjudicated rapist, remains an adjudicated insurrectionist, even if the Supreme Court has wrongly held that the states do not have the power to enforce Section 3 of the 14th Amendment as against potential candidates for federal office.
And when you say they just didn't want to play, because this obviously, I mean, this jumped out at me too, that the opinion didn't talk about whether or not Trump engaged in insurrection. And so it didn't, when we talked about this before, there was this element of like, will they take up the facts as they are presented, or like that they have to take up the facts as presented by the Colorado court? You might have to correct me on this if I'm saying it wrong, but but basically, like, they just don't even, when you say they didn't play, what you mean is they didn't even talk about this at all. It's just not in there. They're not going to talk about that.
They're just not. They were determined to stay absolutely away from anything controversial politically, I think. I think they were terrified for the impact that a decision on that anywhere touched the merits would have on the standing of the court. And you can see that in Justice Barrett's concurring opinion, where she says, the court has settled a politically charged issue in the volatile season of a presidential election. In my judgment, this is not a time to amplify disagreement with stridency. I don't know. I mean, why she's saying that, I think she's terrified.
Well, hold on. Let's talk about Justice. I want to talk about Justice Barrett's concurrence. But hers is just a page, and she starts by agreeing. Right. It's interesting, actually. It's all the women. So she starts by agreeing with Sotomayor, Kagan, and Jackson that the court didn't need to, quote, address the complicated question whether federal legislation is the exclusive vehicle through which Section 3 can be enforced.
So I cannot make heads or tails out of what Justice Barrett says in the first paragraph of her two-paragraph concurring opinion. If she agrees with the other concurring justices, then she shouldn't have joined part 2B of the court's opinion.
This is the part that you were just reading, right, where she says, okay, so she goes on to write, and this is right. This is Coney Barrett, after agreeing with Sotomayor, Kagan, Jackson.
She's saying two inconsistent things here. She's saying, I join part 2B of the court's opinion. Well, part 2B of the court's opinion that she is joining without reservation in that sentence is precisely the part of the opinion that Justices Kagan, Sotomayor, and Jackson took issue with. But yes, she is saying there that she disagrees with a part of your opinion she just said she agreed with. So I can't make
heads or sense. Here's what she says. This is what she says why. And it says, in my judgment, this is not the time to amplify disagreement with stridency. The court has settled a politically charged issue in the volatile season of a presidential election. Particularly in this circumstance, writings on the court should turn the national temperature down, not up. For present purposes, our differences are far less important than our unanimity. All nine justices agree on the outcome of this case. That is the message Americans should take home.
So that's all very nice. That's all very nice. It's a nice thought, but I don't understand what she's doing.
I mean, is she saying, I guess, to your point, she can't square them.
I can't figure out. I find this opinion completely inscrutable. She's basically, as you say, well, first of all, the first sentence, she's disagreeing. She's agreeing with the majority. Right. I join part 2B of the court's opinion. Part 2B is essentially the essence of the opinion. And then she takes it back later in the paragraph that she said she wouldn't. She's essentially saying she wouldn't have joined all of 2B. And that, in that sense, she agrees with the concurring opinions, the concurring opinion of Justice Sotomayor. Then she's saying we shouldn't, she's sort of taking the concurrence to task, perhaps. I mean, that's the only way I can interpret it, as saying we shouldn't be emphasizing our differences here, even though she agrees with the people she seems to agree, and I cannot.
But that's a message to us, isn't it? So the way I hear that,
I think what Justice Barrett wrote here is nonsense and should be disregarded.
The reason I'm interested in it, I think, is because to me it's a political statement. She's making a political statement about the temperature of the country.
Because she's saying, I don't want to get involved when it's really hot.
And it's like, that's why we're sitting out. So she's saying, like, even if I might agree with what they're saying, I think that the most important thing here is that we all agree that this is not something that should be, or like, we all agree
this opinion is inscrutable.
Okay.
Okay. It is inscrutable. It literally contradicts itself. It's like literally five or six sentences long, and it contradicts itself multiple times. So I'm not going to put a lot of weight and I have a great deal of respect for Justice Barrett. I'm not going to put much weight in this opinion. I think it's one of these things that got sort of written at some point when the majority opinion and the concurring opinions were maybe at different places, and they started to move, and then she never really changed it to make it consistent with what happened to the other opinions. The only thing that I credit or that I would interpret Justice Barrett's opinion to demonstrate is that the terror that the court faced in addressing this case. They're just terrified of this case. They were terrified of this case, which is why you have such an incoherent, unsigned opinion that's not persuasive. But that said, I mean, nobody, not even the people who were litigating this case on behalf of the Colorado voters, believed that the Supreme Court was likely to rule in their favor. They thought they had an outside shot, maybe, but none of them ever thought that it was that likely, from what I could tell, and from what I could tell from other people who were advocating the position, against Trump. But I thought they'd do a little bit better than this. And the fact of the matter is, they weren't able to do better than this, and they weren't able to write a convincing opinion, because there was no convincing opinion to be had.
I want to circle back though to the because there's these two concurrences, and I just want to make this really clear to the audience, because this is the part that I think is a little complicated, is that you have Amy Coney Barrett, who's writing one form of concurrence that's different from everybody else's, where she's trying to split the difference. And then you have the concurrences that are specifically from Sotomayor, Jackson, and Kagan. Okay, can you just talk about, because now we've referenced it a bunch, but we haven't quite their concurrence.
Yeah. All right, the Sotomayor concurrence basically says, we agree with the result. Donald Trump should not be knocked off the ballot, but we disagree with all this additional stuff that's in the per curiam opinion about how only Congress can enforce the prohibition against insurrectionists running or holding federal office. Only Congress can do that by statute. We would just leave that issue for another day because it's not right and not good to decide things that aren't really necessary to decide the case. And they're not wrong. That's actually a very, very conservative view of the judicial power. And it's usually the right view of that you shouldn't decide more than absolutely necessary to decide a case, because there may be arguments that may be brought to you in the future that may clarify something about what you are opining about in the abstract unnecessarily. Today, you may find that somebody may come up with a better argument in the future. So it's always best to tailor your opinions and make them as narrow as possible. That being said, the Sotomayor concurrence makes no more sense than the majority opinion. Because there's basically, it just says that, hey, you know, the states can't enforce the 14th Amendment in this case. But there's no basis for concluding that. At least the majority attempted to try to flesh it out a little to make some kind of a consistent theory, a consistent rule about why it is that the states can't do that. And they came up with this kind of superstructure about what the federal Congress can do. I don't think that made any sense, but you know, I just think that, look, I don't think any of the opinions here make any sense. I mean, they're terrible. It's just bad.
And just to be clear, now that this has come out around Colorado, that applies to all the other states.
It's a blanket holding that basically says that the states, no matter what, have no authority to enforce Section 3 of the 14th Amendment against candidates for federal office without some kind of a congressional authorization. That's the bottom line holding. Where that comes from the text of the Constitution, from the history, it doesn't come from anywhere. It's just basically a conclusion in search of reasoning.
And they don't try, right?
It's a weak and pathetic opinion. Sometimes that's what you get from courts.
Well, I guess I was going to ask you, this is more a question about you, actually, but like you and Judge Luttig and some of my, best legal friends, you guys sort of thought that the court, if they looked at any of the arguments straight up and down, that they would have to conclude in favor of Trump being kept off the ballot under the 14th Amendment, Section 3.
Are you surprised
that the court just decided, well, we're actually just not going to look at the textual arguments. We're just going to ignore
I am not surprised, particularly after the argument. I just thought they were going to have to come up with something better. That's what I've always felt. That's what I've always said. And I would never have put money on the plaintiffs winning this case. I think the problem with the Supreme Court is that it has blown its capital on so many other things that it couldn't bring itself to follow the logic in the text of the Constitution in this particular case, because it doesn't feel that it has the political capital to enforce a clear provision of the Constitution, because it has engaged in so many forays that it should probably not have engaged in.
And then my last question on this is, if their posture to some of these Trump cases that are coming in front of them is sort of like hands off, does that give you
Not at all. I mean, the way I look at this is, you can't always get what you want. This is my Mick Jagger view. Mm-hmm. And we were never going to get what we wanted from this opinion. That said, you can get what you need. And what you needed, what was necessary here, was nothing that overturned or questioned the factual finding of the Colorado Supreme Court and the Colorado District Court that Donald Trump is engaged in an insurrection. Nobody's challenging that. Not one word is suggestive of that in the Supreme Court's opinion. You didn't hear one word of it really at the argument suggesting that he was not an insurrectionist. And I think that's actually the important takeaway, because, I've talked to a lot of people about this case. And I did not find a single person at any point in time saying, I think when the Supreme Court really gets to this and focuses on it, the plaintiffs are going to win. Nobody said that. Maybe they said, in a perfect world, maybe you could get lucky, maybe you could get the, but nobody that I know of would have put actual money on the Supreme Court deciding this case in favor of the plaintiffs. That said, I thought they'd come up with something better than this. And the fact that they didn't shows basically how wrong the opinion is. That said, I don't think it is their fear of this particular case, of taking Donald Trump off the ballot and of finding him on the basis of a district court record in Colorado to be an insurrectionist. I don't see that as a huge victory for Donald Trump, precisely because they didn't touch the factual findings. But also because, you know, in this immunity case, I don't think he want, you know, I people viewed what happened last week when the court decided to hear the immunity case. They viewed that as a victory for Donald Trump. And I don't, you know, as I said last week, I don't think it's a victory. I think they decided they had to say something about that. And I think at the end of the day, it may end up hurting Donald Trump because he's going to end up quite possibly on trial in October and November. I don't think the Supreme Court's didn't do this to do Donald Trump any favors. They didn't decide this case this way to do Donald Trump any favors. They didn't decide the prior cases that he brought up to the Supreme Court where he was arguing for special treatment under the law in the Manhattan DA investigation, in those cases that went up to the court in 2019. And they're not out to do him any favors, and they're not out to do him any favors in the immunity case as well. I mean, that said, I think that basically the court's not going to save us. It never was going to save us. And at the end of the day, it's not going to prevent justice from prevailing by virtue of the fact that they're not going to rule in his favor in the immunity case. They're just not. So that's where I come out. I mean, I could go on and on about this opinion, but it would be boring.
Okay. Well, no, we don't need to go on and on because you just explained it incredibly clearly. And
I don't know.
I understand
okay,
it now.
Right. Okay, you understand it.
But I thank you, George, for hopping on this emergency podcast. And
it's
I want to thank
emergency,
everybody
yes.
for listening. This was an emergency. All right. Don't forget to hit subscribe. Leave a review on your podcast app. Email us at askgeorge@thebulwark.com. And we will see you later this week for a regular episode. Thanks, guys. Thanks, George.
Bye. Bye.